This is a podcast from ABC Overnights.
Now, Leslie Ann Jones is an author of many books, including the one we're going to be chatting about now. Now, the world that knew David Bowie as the most innovative musician of his generation would be surprised to know that Leslie Ann Jones knew him as a boy from Bromley, desperate to make it, frustrated by an industry that wouldn't give him a break, and hell-bent on achieving fame and fortune at any cost. Does that pretty much sum your relationship with him up, Leslie?
Oh, you've done a good job there, Brad. Hi, how are you?
Very well indeed. Now, before we talk about Bowie, this is a question from left field, because you also wrote the definitive biography about Freddie Mercury. Have you seen the movie, and what did you think?
I saw it three times. The first time it made me very cross because there were so many liberties taken with the truth and with the chronology. And I came away thinking, why did they have to do that? Why did they have to rewrite the story? Because history is exact. And then the second time I went with some friends and I felt a little bit more relaxed about it because I'd heard Brian May, the guitarist, talking about the fact that, look, it's not a documentary, it's a feature film. And to cram somebody's 45-year life into a 2.5-hour film, you know, that's difficult. You've got to cut corners. So I thought, okay. Third time I went with my kids and I spent the whole 2.5 hours watching them. And I got it. The penny dropped. The film is a vehicle for the music. And it's really for those fans who were not born when Freddie was already dead. And it's a fantastic vehicle for that classic Queen rock. And that is why it's the highest grossing musical biopic of all time. Mm. And has already made about £700 million.
Yes, phenomenal. It's a great movie. But I have to say, a friend of ours, there was a group of about 8 of us. And at the end, one of them started crying. And my wife said, "No, what's wrong?" She said, "I forgot that he died."
I don't mean to laugh. I really don't mean to laugh because I miss him to this day.
But oh, yeah. As you would. But, I just thought it was...
He was so full of life, wasn't he? Yeah. He was so vibrant and so gigantic as an artist that it's hard to believe, seeing a film like that he's actually gone.
Very true. Will we see a movie like that about David Bowie?
I'm really hoping, you know, this is a secret, but I'll tell you. Mm. I got an email from Graham King a couple of weeks ago, who is the executive producer of Bohemian Rhapsody. And we have a mutual friend who works for Variety magazine in Los Angeles. And he got my email address and he sent me a message and said, "I'm just reading your David Bowie." So everything is crossed in my household that he might come back and say, "Can we please buy the rights?"
Fantastic. And would you like to be involved in it, or would you have the opportunity? I'm not too sure how it works. If they buy the rights to the book, do you have carte blanche to ride over that, or are you...
You don't. You absolutely don't. Your agent does a deal with whoever is looking for those movie rights. They buy them for a set period of time for a set amount of money, and then usually they get renewed over time. The Queen film took 10 years,
right?
From the first concept to it actually appearing on the screen. It takes a long, long time. But with Bohemian Rhapsody, I did actually script consult for Peter Morgan, who was the original screenwriter. They didn't use his script in the end, but I'm quite glad they didn't, really, because it was completely different from the one that appeared. But they did credit him at the end of the movie anyway, because he had provided the first script. But for me, they moved a little bit too far away from the true story, and I wouldn't have wanted my name on it. And all I'm saying to everybody about that film is, if you want to know the truth, please read my book, because it's all there.
Well done. So you were a Bowie friend as well as a Bowie fan, I guess. Was that difficult?
No, I met him when I was really young because we just happened to live in the same small town. Just a place called Beckenham outside of Bromley. We both went to school in Bromley. He was quite a few years older than me, but we did overlap. We bought our records in the same shop. We went to the same library gardens. We went to the same market square to catch the bus. You know, all those places that he wrote about in his songs. And when Space Oddity became a surprising hit in 1969 because of the moon landings in July that year, and he'd written Space Oddity, the BBC had picked it up as the soundtrack for their coverage of those moon landings. So he had a hit with that, and he suddenly was a star out of nowhere. He'd been trying to be a star for 10 years. You know, and he tried everything. He'd been a folk singer, a mime artist, a vaudevillian, a pop star, a mod. He literally couldn't give it away. And then suddenly he comes out with this song, which had started life as just purely a folk song. BBC picked it up, and there he was, our local hero, and there's nothing like a local hero. So, of course, all little kids start to find out where he lived, go around his house, doorstep him, you know, knock on the door, get signed photos, get sent away. And I remember saying to my friend Natasha, who is also a big fan, she even called herself Ziggy after him, and I said, one day, Angie, his partner, she'll be out, right, and he's going to open the door, and he'll let us in. And that's exactly what happened. We went round one afternoon after school, and he answered the door wearing a lemon silk kimono, nothing else, barefoot, everything. He was painting his fingernails with black nail polish, and he invited us in for tea, and he didn't have any milk. And we sat there talking about spaceships and the musical Hair that he'd auditioned for but didn't get a part. And we were trying to be so cool. And I look back and I think, what absolute idiots we were.
Oh, yeah, but what a story to tell. I mean, and it's just a sign of the times back then that that you could do something, is that not only find out, you know where he lives, but just knock on the door and having a, yeah, come on in, we'll just have a cuppa.
It just wouldn't happen now, would it? But I remember now looking back, there were people who were obviously not yet, but who became Boy George and Billy Idol and various other people, Susie and the Banshees. You know, these were the kind of kids rocking up on his doorstep to try and touch him, just get a piece of him, because I think we knew already that he was a kind of man who fell to Earth. He wasn't of this planet. He just seemed to have arrived here by other means than normal human beings do. And he lived up to that sort of alter ego throughout his entire life.
We have to ask, I've had a couple of texts through already, what kind of tea did he serve and was his house tidy?
I remember that, well, the tea, first of all, he didn't have any milk, so we just had black tea, but it was normal sort of, you know, kitchen tea, PG tips, breakfast tea, I suppose we'd call it. It wasn't very nice. I don't think he really was in the habit of doing much domestically.
Cups of tea for total strangers that knock on the door.
Yes. It was a very interesting place. It's not there anymore, tragically, and I always think this wonderful sort of Gothic mansion with turrets and kind of, you know, you imagine bats flying out the top, and it's been knocked down and there are blocks of flats there now, but it was the most extraordinary place, and it had a minstrel's gallery, and the sitting room was like Christmas coloured, you know, it had the bottle green walls and red velvet covered sofas, and his bedroom had a silver ceiling and a kind of pink blanket lying on the bed. And I remember there was an old-fashioned wooden ironing board. Imagine a wooden ironing board. I had one of those with donkey's ears. My grandmother had one. And that was in the middle of the room, and there was a shirt hanging off the side. You know, it was quite untidy. But I don't think Angie was that bothered about domesticity either, let's say.
No, okay. So they're a marriage made in heaven, or a union made in heaven there.
Definitely, yeah.
So as time went on, what's your favourite thing about Bowie?
My favourite thing about
him? You were talking, like, answering the door in the yellow kimono and painting his nails black and that sort of thing. Was it that he was his own man, that he just didn't really care what others thought? Or
I think he did care. He cared very much. I mean, you know, he had a very dysfunctional childhood and background. There was some paranoid schizophrenia in his background. His mother was a very strange woman. She'd already had two kids out of wedlock when he came along, and she'd given one of them away. She was adopted out, his sister. And his brother, Terry, who was 10 years older, was actually blighted by the family affliction and ended up committing suicide, in fact. And I think David always feared that this madness, the family madness, would have touched him. But I think trying to escape that was also the thing that inspired his creativity. There's always a void in these A-list rock stars. You know, you don't have to dig very deep for it. I'm thinking somebody like John Lennon, you know, both parents abandoned him. Michael Jackson, we know what went on in that family. George Michael the same. But there's generally a theme of that kind running through. But what I loved about him was that the David I met when I was a child never changed. And I was just an ordinary kid. I wasn't musical, wasn't artistic. And I remember sitting in his house that day thinking, I need to grow up and be with people like this. But I didn't know how I was going to do it because I didn't have any of his talents. And then the pennies dropped a while later. My dad was a sports writer on a newspaper. And I thought, that's it, I can do that. I can write about bands. I can go on the road with them and join the clown and write gig reviews and do interviews. And that's exactly what I did. So David Bowie inspired my entire career. And in the end, I was going on planes with him and going to gigs around the world and doing interviews with him. And in fact, he lent me his house in Mystique in the 90s when I was writing my second book on Freddie Mercury. And we'd become pretty good friends by this time. And I used to see him in Paris. I used to see him in Switzerland. And then I took to going to New York a lot where he was living now, and we bumped into each other, and he'd say, what are you doing for dinner? Come and have some dinner. We'd go to Indochine. And, you know, we just hung out. And I think the appeal was, this would never happen today, by the way.
No.
You know, journalists and artists don't get that close anymore. But back then we did, and we could. And you had that free rein because there weren't the publicists, the agents, the record company people, the hangers-on. If you were doing an interview with David Bowie, you would be in a room with him by yourself. And then he might say, do you want to go out for dinner? You know, and you'd do that. Do you want to come to Dusseldorf next week? And you'd do that. And it's quite unthinkable. When I sometimes teach journalism classes now and I explain how this used to work, people look at me as if I'm making it up.
I can imagine they do. We're chatting with Leslie Ann Jones, the author of Hero, David Bowie. Now, when you were saying before about, you know, having an interview and then getting to chat and then going out for dinner, was there anything with the two of you that was off the record? Was it a constructed interview and then you went out for dinner? Was anything that was said at dinner, was that, you know, free range for him as well for you to report on or chat about?
David was very relaxed about that kind of thing. He wasn't one to say, oh, you know, this is off the record, because that is red rag to a bull as far as a journalist is concerned. You know, anybody ever say to you, but by the way, I don't want this to go any further, immediately your ears prick up and you think, headline. But he was very relaxed. He set out to be different and to shock. You know, we all know that he was married when he gave his famous interview saying that he was bisexual and that he had an affair with Mick Jagger and that kind of thing. I think he was the first bi sex symbol, and he knew that he was worshipped as a teen idol. He was revered as a rock star. He was lusted after by all different kinds of people. And back in the early 70s, that was quite shocking. Nowadays, it's the norm, it's expected. But back then, I think he knew what he was doing. He was a very clever man. He knew how to command headlines. And the way to do that in the early 70s was to tell stories about your private life that might be at odds with what people really wanted to read. Of course, everybody fell on all this stuff, and we were both shocked and thrilled because we couldn't be like that. We would never live up to his dimensions, if you like.
Yeah,
I remember being at... Go on.
No, sorry. I was just saying he was forever reinventing himself, though, wasn't he? But he was also staying true to himself at the same time, I guess, which would be very difficult.
I think the reinventions were very contrived. And we know that he was a plagiarist. We read about him being a tasteful thief. That was the phrase they so often used. But he ripped everybody off. You know, if you haven't got to delve or scratch very hard against his music to find inspiration from all genres of music down all the ages. And he made no bones about that. But I think he was always one step ahead. And he was clever about that, because each time he came up with a new identity, it was a whole different set of rules, and everybody would abandon the previous. You know, you'd go to a concert and he'd be in a at certain guys, and the audience would all be dressed up in the guys previous, because they weren't yet aware of what he was doing.
What was coming up.
That was very funny. My favourite was the Ziggy Stardust years.
Why is that?
I think just because I was on the threshold of my teens, and he'd created this character that I think it was really a reaction to not having been able to give it away in the music business so long. And the irony was that his alter ego almost wound up destroying him. Ziggy Stardust became more famous than David Bowie for a while, so he had to kill him off. And the Spiders, you know, those closest were the last to know, of course. The band, that night at the Hammersmith Odeon, July 1973, they didn't even know they were getting the sack that night, and they got sacked on stage. And there were riots.
How did that go down? How does that happen? You finish the set, finish the concert, and then, by the way, guys...
Well, it's a famous phrase, isn't it? He said, not only is this the last show of the tour, but it's the last show we'll ever do. And the band are all standing there going, what? Open mouthed. I think Mick Ronson, the guitarist, had a vague inkling. I think he'd been tipped off, but the rest of the band didn't know. And there were stampedes in the place. And the band played on. It was rock and roll suicide. But imagine how clever that was. Because obviously nobody wanted this new superstar to vanish overnight. They thought, I think everybody did think, we must have all thought that that was it. He was never going to do anything ever again. But of course, what he was killing off was Ziggy, the alter ego. David Bowie was coming back as somebody else.
Yeah, fascinating stuff when you think back that long ago and to be that clever. How much... do you think it was to his detriment? Well, obviously, the Ziggy persona took over, but do you think at the start of when he was coming up with these sort of ideas of himself that he expected it to be as successful as it was?
I think he always was very desperate for stardom, and whatever it took, he was going to go for it. I don't think his wife, Angie, got the credit she deserved. I remember when I went to the David Bowie Ears exhibition at the V&A in London in 2013, and there wasn't a whiff of her anywhere. She'd completely been airbrushed out of his history.
Wow.
And I found that offensive because she was the one who was encouraging him to experiment with fashion. She was sewing the costumes. You know, she was designing them. She was pushing him harder and harder to experiment musically. But then they'd had this horribly acrimonious divorce, and he'd won custody of their son, and it was all horrible, and she ended up with no money. And I think there was a massive level of guilt in David about the way Angie had been treated. And her life didn't really pan out so great, you know. But then David did find the love of his life. He found Iman. And after many, many attempts, they managed to have another child together. And by that stage in his life, he had everything he ever wanted. You know, you get to middle age and you want different things, don't you, from when you're young. And I think that a loving marriage and a home life and a little child to bring up, making the music he really wanted to make. And, of course, he also had emotional and physical stability by this time. He had a routine. I think it's a massive thing for a musician to have a routine and to have somebody behind you rooting for you. And he had all this by then. And because Iman wasn't competing with him for fame, she'd had her career.
Right, yes.
Whereas I think with Angie, it was a whole different thing.
Now, what was he like as a father?
Well, but I think by the time he got to Lexi, his little girl, she must be in her late teens now, I guess, but I think he was ready for it by then. I don't think he was ready for Zoe, as he was originally called, Duncan Jones, the filmmaker as we know him now. I just think David wasn't ready for that yet. Lots of men aren't at that stage in the game. He's only in his 20s, and that's very young, isn't it?
Yeah, and doing what he was doing and the lifestyle that he had, yeah. That's,
and taking a lot of drugs and travelling all the time. Duncan was pretty much brought up by his nanny, and he went to boarding school in Scotland. He went to Gordonstoun, and during the holidays, he didn't come back to London to be with his father or even visit his mother. He didn't see his mother for years and years, but he went to the parents of his nanny in Scotland to spend the holidays.
That's amazing, isn't it?
It's quite dysfunctional.
Well, it... Yeah, well, that just seems to be, as you said, a common theme, you know, through those people. The other thing, too, that's a common theme, just thinking about Freddie Mercury, Prince, all little guys, what was going on? Do you think it was do you think it was small man syndrome that made him as good as he was?
What, with David?
Yeah.
Well, David was tall. David wasn't a small guy at all. I don't know
why. Well, how tall was he?
Well, he's taller than me, and I'm, what am I, about 5'6"?
Oh, OK. All right, then, yeah.
David wasn't small.
I know Prince was little because I cooked for Prince once.
You cooked for him?
Yeah, yeah. I was a chef at the tennis centre here in Melbourne, and there's a photo somewhere, sadly, that I've lost. I cooked for the band and while they were performing, and then after the show, someone came up and they said, oh, look, we're going on a boat tour of Port Phillip Bay. Would you like to join us? And I said, yes. And I arrived where we were leaving from and the whole band were there and I was in my chef's gear with my knife and all that sort of thing, just assuming that I'd have to be doing barbecue duties on the back of the boat. But they actually had me there just to enjoy the day. And there was a photo somewhere of me with my chef's pants rolled up and my white chef's jacket all starched up and rolled up as well, standing next to Prince and the band out in Port Phillip Bay.
You have to find that photo.
I do. I really do.
Oh, my God. Somebody must have the negative of that
Yeah,
picture.
You'd hope so. I felt like a real gazoober as I rocked up onto
that's
the...
That's a claim to fame.
Yes, it certainly is. We've got George on the line with a question for you. Good morning, George.
Sorry, Brad. I'm just trying to come to terms with that image in my head of you.
Yeah. Yes, my little mate. Yes. Yeah. Now you've got a question for Leslie.
Yeah. Well, I've probably got a lot of questions, but I'll try to restrict myself to one. But
yeah, thank you.
Very, very appropriate, of course, with a name like Jones that you know she wrote the biography because obviously it was David Jones, so I thought that was highly appropriate. But I just wanted to ask Leslie. David famously had a bit of sojourn in Australia where he stayed in King's Cross in Sydney in an apartment kind of incognito and really succeeded, I think, in staying pretty much incognito. But I just wondered if she could fill us in on the background of why he wanted to come here, because he seemed to have a very close relationship with Australia. I mean, you mentioned the Corinda Hotel where the Let's Dance video was shot before, which came out of that, I think, period to a degree. But it seemed to be like a sabbatical that he was taking. I have a second shot, the question that divides all David Bowie fans, Leslie's opinion on the Tin Machine era, thumbs up or thumbs down, as a second little add-on if she's got time.
Goodness, that is a lot of questions all in one. Well, I've written in the book about the fact that David fell in love with Australia. They went there to shoot some videos, and they fell in love with the light. Actually, it was quite a simple thing in those days of early video making. And it was a similar relationship that he had with New York when he went there the first time. He was left alone. He could be himself and people didn't bother him. And he really liked that relationship with Australians. He had respect for his private life and didn't follow him around. You know, in New York, same thing. He could go for a walk in Central Park and people didn't mob him. They didn't follow him about. They didn't charge up and thrust things under his nose to sign. It was much more civilized for him. I think there was quite a lot of hysteria going on in the UK and parts of Europe for David at that time. And Australia was somewhere where he could be himself. And in fact, he did buy himself an apartment there, didn't he? And had that for some years. But your question about Tin Machine, I didn't quite get. Could you repeat that, please?
Oh, we've lost George. But was it a thumbs up or a thumbs down? Did you think it worked, or were you quite disappointed?
It was an interesting period. I think he wanted to get back to performing with his own band on the road. And it was an attempt to be one of a band again, wasn't it? The music didn't work for everyone because I think it was a bit basic. It was a bit obscure. I think there were aspects of it that were musically pleasing. But it certainly seemed like a step out of the Bowie route, if you like.
Okay.
And it didn't thrill everybody, did it?
Well, no, but I guess if you're pushing the envelope all the time, pushing the boundaries, then there is going to be times when it just doesn't appeal to everybody. But is it important with the relationships you've had with various musicians? Is it important to them that people like what they do, or is it important to them that they like what they do? Is it just a consequence that it becomes successful and popular with other people?
I think there's artistic integrity there at a level at which David was by then. I think, you know, it's not just, it's not lazy. It's not pump anything out because the fans love me and they'll just buy it. Mm. I think the creative integrity has to be the kernel, the nugget of the, you know, the starting point of whatever they take forward. And you're taking a risk every time, as he took with Tin Machine. But, you know, David was quite perverse in lots of ways, and I think he may have decided to create something like Tin Machine as a test, in a way. You know, to see, are my fans that discerning musically?
Well, there's one way to find out, I guess, yeah.
You know, are they just going to snap up anything? And I think, you know, in those days, critics had an enormous voice. I think we've seen from the success of Bohemian Rhapsody, the movie, that critics really don't mean anything at all anymore, because that film was universally panned here in the UK, and I wrote quite a few pieces in the newspapers myself about what I felt about it. But it didn't mean a thing. What made that film was bums on seats, word of mouth, Twitter and Facebook. The fans loved it. Mm. So who cares what the critics say anymore? You know, if the fans love whatever David Bowie puts out, I think we tend to forget, you know, when he'd been away for quite a while, we thought we'd had the last of him. And then in 2015, a new single came out of nowhere. Do you remember? Black Star, 10 minutes long.
Yes.
This macabre video that seemed to hint at impending death, and it hardly troubled the charts. And then there was Lazarus, and everybody's going, what's this about? And then a new album comes out on his 69th birthday, and this was Black Star, and it was very obscure compared to some of the things that we knew and loved David Bowie for. And then, you know, then he died, and so this became the album about his death, which I think was terribly brave.
Mm.
But then we had the issue of, did he kill himself? You know, was this assisted suicide? Because it just seemed the timing was so contrived in a way. It was his birthday on the 8th of January, and that was the day they released the album. And then 2 days later, he died. It just seemed to many people.
Do you think it was?
I couldn't possibly say.
Yeah.
I had no idea. But I understand people who say that it was too coincidental. And it would have been, had he done it, who could blame him? Because we know he had cancer, but we didn't know at the time.
Hmm.
But if he did do that, who could blame him? It seemed to me a bit of a classic David Bowie move.
Yeah, well, you can't knock him for doing it, can you? I mean, if that's the case, a man who lived by his own terms has every right to die by them as well.
I agree.
Now, Norman has a question for you. Good morning, Norman. Oh, Norman's put us on hold. I'll fade Norman off there quietly. That's there's a first. Now, Paul has text through. I'll put him back on hold, and let's see if we can. If we can get him back up again. Paul from West Brunswick says, who was the influence that got Bowie into films, and how much did he like it? Why did he make so few? Because I found his performances very solid.
I disagree with that, with respect. I think David was a fantastic star of his own videos. Those shorts, you know, they were so creative and so colourful, and they illustrated the songs that they accompanied so very well. But I think in the longer format, the feature films, he seemed quite wooden, and he always appeared to be acting. I think when Nick Rogue cast him as the man who fell to earth, that was fantastic casting. And I think that was as good as it got, because there was something ethereal and otherworldly about David that Nick obviously picked up on. But trying to play other characters, I didn't ever find him plausible. And I think that was probably the reason why he made so few, because I think he felt that too.
What was the... was it Mr. Lawrence? Was that the...
Yeah, that was... I can't remember the full title of that, actually. That's gone off the top of my head.
But, yeah.
Yeah, that I didn't think that was really very good at all.
But, and yeah, because I wondered about the casting of that too. You know, why he wouldn't have been my first thought to actually play that. Yeah, Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. It wouldn't have been
Merry
my
Christmas,
first thought,
Lawrence.
But he obviously is the sort of guy, well, I'll give it a try. Now, hopefully we've got Norman back on the line. Norman, how are you?
Yeah, I'm just going to ring up. With Sir Paul and Sir Mick and Sir Elton, I used to get cranky that David wasn't made a knight. And then I found out later that he turned it down. Can I ask why he turned it down?
Great question. Thank you very much.
It is a great question. We can't know without being able to ask him. But I think knowing David as I did, that would have been an establishment step too far. He was quite scornful of awards and anything that sort of smacked of establishment. You know, he stood outside of all that. And I think he was quite impressed when John Lennon returned his MBE to the Queen. And I think David liked the idea of copying that. He was influenced by John Lennon quite a lot. And I think to have accepted something like that would have been to have become too establishment, and he just didn't fancy it.
Simple as that. Now, Eva's text in. Now, I'm not too sure if you can help us with this or not. I wonder if you ever met Richard Sahara, perhaps. He did the lightning makeup for him, and he was an Australian and an incredible artist.
No, I never did meet him, but yes, how amazing was that image. I am wearing, you obviously can't see me, but in your honour, and because we're having this conversation, I'm wearing a sweater with the Flash, the Aladdin Sane Flash, right across the front of my sweater. And it's one of those instantly recognisable images of David, isn't it? It's never going to go away. And genius creativity.
Now, with the with his appearance, can you tell us what happened with the eyes?
Well, I can. There's a story about his best friend from school who was a chap called George Underwood. Mm-hmm. And they met in the Wolf Cubs. They both went to Bromley Technical School, but they'd met in the Wolf Cubs when they were about 8 or 9 years old. And they became best friends for life because their first ever conversation was about music, about skiffle, in fact. The Lonnie Donegan, Rock Island Line era that nobody knows what I'm talking about because nobody was born. And George was the one who noticed that David was very obsessed with things for very short periods of time. But they did become best friends, and they had a fight over a girl called Carol Goldsmith when they were both 15, mm-hmm. because George had asked Carol out, and David was envious. And because of that, he went and told George that Carol had cancelled so that David could ask her out himself. And then the next day in the playground, David was gloating. You know, you didn't get to go out with Carol Goldsmith, but I got to go out with her. And George, infuriated, he punched David in the eye. And this was said to have caused David's mismatched eye condition. Probably it didn't. It's believed that he had a condition called anisocoria, which is a visible difference between the size of the two pupils. But in fact, 1/5 of the population has this affliction.
Okay.
In the case of a trauma, which, you know, say the punch, mm-hmm. the damage isn't done to the eye or to the supporting muscles, but to those parasympathetic nerves that control the pupil at the back of the eye. So, you know, my medical research led to it being highly likely that David was a victim of congenital syphilis, which can lead to that kind of sight impairment and also affect mental health, which could explain, you know, why his brother developed paranoid schizophrenia. Mm. We can't possibly know for sure, but that is the closest theory that I got to by interviewing medical experts. But, you know, David was very proud of that sort of weirdness of his eyes, and he used to put nasal drops into his eye to irritate that enlarged pupil and to make it enlarge even further.
That's amazing. Well, you know, if you're standing at a bar with somebody and they say, "So, mate, tell us about your eye," the story of, you know, 15 and fighting with your best mate over a girlfriend and getting a punch in the eye is so much better than saying, "Oh, look, we think it might have been congenital syphilis."
And of course, he wouldn't have known that anyway.
But, no, exactly. So,
when his mother was a young woman, there weren't medical records kept. You know, we didn't get those until after World War II. So medical records were not available for him to have looked anything like that up anyway. But I remember when I went, I was about 6 months pregnant in 1987, and David was on the Glass Spider Tour, and they'd invited me, it was May 87, to Rotterdam to go and do the first interview. And David always liked to do the interviews before he went out on stage. Most rock stars like to do them after.
Yeah.
So there I was, 6 months pregnant. I couldn't fly, so I had to go on the train up to Harwich, take a ferry overnight. I was sick 27 times on this ferry. Got the other side, then a train all the way down to Amsterdam. I was staying in the Amsterdam Hilton, and then a taxi to Rotterdam. And I put in different colored contact lenses. In fact, I put in a green one and a purple one.
Yeah.
Just, you know, kind of off the wall. So rocked up backstage at the Feyenoord football stadium and knocked on his dressing room door. And he opened the door and he looked me in the eyes. And then his eyes fell to my huge belly. And then he just said, "Yeah, very funny. Can we just do this?"
Well, that'll teach you for upstaging the star. Ah, dear,
yeah,
dear.
He never let me live that down.
Oh, that is fantastic. Leslie Ann Jones, the author of Hero, the David Bowie book. Go and grab it if you're a Bowie fan, because it is a really interesting read. There's a lot of things that we haven't had time to touch on there. I really appreciate you joining us today, and more power to you. And you've got 10 seconds in the next book.
The next book I can announce today.
Yes, go for it.
It's a commemorative book of John Lennon, which is going to come out next year for his 40th anniversary of his death.
Thank you.